right now, contemporarily or historically? Contemporarily. I think the that variety of actors active in Myanmar, and they are dubbed as sort of China, right? But most of, let's say, state level, obviously you have state-to-state diplomatic relations, right? And you have some kind of involvement into the peace process itself. And then in terms of investment-wise, at least the SOEs, they are state-owned enterprises, right? And most of them probably are involved in bigger projects, like in natural resource, minerals and dams and etc. And then you have lots of basically private entities, petty businesses, and you know, private individuals, right? Basically, do go to Myanmar to make money, right? And so those people are not coordinated necessarily from the state, right? So that's why you have people who go to Myanmar. They probably take advantage of China's state incentives, right? The opium substitution programs or not, but it's not state intention, right? It's more like these people to take advantage of those policies, and then they go to Myanmar. They probably, lease land from the peasants or from the middlemen, and then they do lots of bad things. You know, perhaps they don't really take care of the environment, and then they have lots of disputes with locals. But usually they are private individuals, and they want to make money out of it, right? So I think in terms of Chinese influence in Myanmar itself, obviously it's much more comprehensive than a very foreign kind of entity, in a way that China for Southeast Asia, historically, is the familiar other. It's always there. It's not somebody who just came from, I mean, probably that's not a good analogy, but essentially that historically anybody knows that what China is, and always Chinese are always part of it in a way. So in that case, when we think about contemporary Chinese influence in Myanmar or in other South Asian states, some of them are state-directed and state-intended kind of influences, right? They want to change their foreign policy, they want to have some kind of state level interactions, but much of them are out of control of the state. They were private entities, right? And some probably even gangsters, right? They are the bad elements, basically got kicked out from domestic political purges, you know? And even during Cultural Revolution period, lots of people who end up in Myanmar, they took up arms. Some of them basically are runaway youth who cannot tolerate the Cultural Revolution, and that's why they end up in Myanmar, because it was too much going on, and they just crossed the mountain and got in Myanmar. You become more free, that kind of sense. So you do have lots of cases like that as well. So in some ways, the amount of people who are active in Myanmar is not easily countable. And I would say Chinese citizens who were there, the number is actually quite high. And then many of them are not under the control of the state at all, right? And then you also have lots of, how to say, domestic collaborators from Myanmar itself. So you have lots of Myanmar, Chinese origin probably, but national. They might have, the pink card, right? So they can have lots of kind of collaborative businesses, and then, they do trade of this and everything, the kind of thing, yeah.
Can I just ask a follow-up question?
Yeah.
Can you talk specifically about the People's Liberation Army and its continued its activities in the WA state and support for the United
States? I don't think there's direct PLA support for the WA state. Yeah, I think, so I'm not obviously an expert on this one, but I think Andrew Ong, right? Andrew Ong is at NUS, and he spent a lot of time in the WA state. And apparently, according to him, like, was not some of the analysis, like, for example, at one point, right, there was one report by Jane's analysis that was heavily quoted, basically, WA state had a helicopter. It was basically supposedly purchased from China. But he said that really didn't really exist. That was actually a rumor. So I don't know. There's so many speculations of where how the WA developed its weapons. And I suspect is some of them probably are copies of the Chinese model, right? So in a way that you have some kind of, let's say, earlier versions, probably older versions of Chinese weapon systems, and then they learned how to make them internally, mm-hmm. and that's how they're doing it. Some probably are purchased from black market, and I actually suspect Thailand. Yeah, I think Thailand actually is, in my opinion, is where lots of the things go. and people don't really talk about, right? And so lots of black market, and Thai military, I would say, actually is very corrupt. So I would not be surprised that basically you can get something out of from Thailand through money, from bribing of some, obviously not the sophisticated things, but some of the low-end ones.
Although it's difficult to quantify Chinese state support for armed groups and non-state actors within Burma, I'm kind of wondering about the contradictions in Chinese policy, and definitely where we can find a concrete example maybe is Chinese cover for ethnic cleansing and the Rakhine State, the UN and other multilateral institutions, in the sense that through BRI, China has a lot of investments in Burma.
Right.
And what I'm confused about in looking at this picture is, why are they letting the Burmese state pursue ethnic cleansing and therefore feeling more ethnic conflict in places where they're investing? I mean, that seems
right. So I think you're right. But I think, to be honest though, I think the reason why Myanmar state is purging the Rohingya is out of control of anybody. It's Myanmar's own thing, right? And I think there are lots of speculations of why Myanmar government is doing the particular things in Rakhine State. First of all, I would say this is not the first time they did in Rakhine. Right? This is not anything new. The Rakhine thing has going on for many, many decades. Right? So the same kind of purges and killing, kicking out the Rohingyas from Myanmar occurred in the 70s, early 1990s, and now. Right? So it's not anything new. Right? That's the first thing. The second thing is the strategies they use in Rakhine is also nothing new, right? Burning villages, raping women, that's a common strategy used by Myanmar military in Xiang State, in many other places. So what's new, I would say, this time around was the international media presence in the country that widely reported to such a scale. So the Myanmar state has been doing this all the time. Previously, nobody talked about it, but now people become very focused on the Rakhine thing itself. So I don't think it's something that it was the Chinese tolerated or supported. Rather, it was, I can confidently argue that the intention for the Myanmar state to purge Rohingya was 100% its own. It's internal politics. It's how should I say, it's domestic, like say, it's citizenship laws, and it's a long history of anti-Muslim sentiment, anti-South Asian kind of sentiment. So that basically led to the contemporary state. But I think that it's purely domestic.
Yeah. As a follow-up comment, what I'm wondering about is the fact that when it comes to a lot of internal conflicts,
right,
the UN being denounced by one side or another,
yeah,
China and Russia really like to make sure that those resolutions sink.
Yes.
They want to be able to ethnic cleanse in their own countries, essentially.
Mm.
So, I mean, if this has been going on for so long and it's recognized that that is China's stance when it comes to those issues, I mean, couldn't it potentially send a message and this is not for humanitarian reasons, this is for the fact that there are, other than the Rohingya issue, there's about three other major civil wars going on in Burma. Again, I'm imagining that if those were more under control, the environment for Chinese investment would be a lot more stable.
Right.
So I'm thinking about this from an economic perspective.
Yes, but the thing is, it's not a Chinese state can control it, right? So in some ways, obviously, like, I mean, in some ways, this, like you can say, if you want to have like a BOI or whatever, right? The peaceful border, stable border, obviously is going to be better for infrastructure development, for trade, for everything, right? But certainly, in some ways, you can say there might be some influences on certain ethnic groups, ethnic armed groups, but then it's not the Chinese state can dictate them in terms of what they want or what they can do, right? So that's why I think whether the Myanmar can achieve any internal peace is in some ways its own problem. So that's the. Yes.
You know, my question is on your analysis. Yeah? You talk about the Thai and Chinese influence, but it seems to me that the Kachin State and the Shan State have their own imperatives.
Say again. Sorry.
The Kachin State and the Shan State,
yeah,
have their own imperatives. So can you talk about how their state making ambitions are? and why are they in cahoots with Rangoon? They seem to go to the peace talks with Rangoon. They want to be part of the Burmese state, not the Chinese state or the Thai state.
Yeah.
Why is that?
So I think Kachin State actually is much more coherent. I think the KIA has more sort of coherent nation-building projects for its of its own, right? But Shan State is much more complicated. Shan State is quite fragmented in itself, and there are many, many different ethnic armed groups, and then different ethnic rebel ethnic groups as well, and then so that's why you cannot have a one particular group. Sort of can unify all the forces in the Shan State, right? So I would say in terms of you want to say a nation building project, I think Kachin State is much more coherent than the Shan State. Shan State, lots of things right now happening, lots of insurgencies. In fact, not really fighting against central government. Rather, it was different armed groups fighting each other, right? So you have the Shan State Army South, for example, came to the north. Now they're fighting with the Da'ang and other ones. Basically, they said that they're taking over mountains from those other minority groups. Right? So much of the fighting were among them rather than with the central government per se. And that is not really any sort of a coherent, let's say, nationalistic ideology that tied the whole Shan State together, right? Does that answer your question?
No, not quite.
Okay.
I mean, my point is, why is you say Kachin State is more coherent?
Yeah.
So why aren't they? You tend to portray these areas as though they're just subject to Chinese and Thai influence. But there are also actors within the Kachin State who are manipulating these outsiders.
Yes.
So how does that fit into your analysis?
So you're right in a way that you have lots of, let's say, in terms of nation building projects, right? I would say the influence for China and Thailand is complicated. So I'll use an example. Many of the Shan nationalist groups, for example, they were supported by Thailand, at least culturally, right? So Thai's sort of the historic image of itself and its relation with the Shan, the Thai in the upland region, basically means that Thai state tend to spend lots of cultural capital at least to support many of the Shan nationalist movements. But the problem of that in a sense was that so that means you can have lots of, let's say, cultural productions of Shan nationalist kind of product, right? Many of them were basically printed in Thailand and shipped them into Myanmar itself. But on the other hand, though, that's basically the encountering comes into force. So let's say that the Shan in Myanmar, and then many of them actually do end up in Thailand to work as migrant labor, right? But then they at a certain point, obviously many of them do speak Thai, but then they tend to be discriminated against as well, right? They are considered as sort of a poorer and a more backward versions of the country people, right? So that's why in some ways this encountering of the Thai sometimes actually reinforce themselves as being Burmese. I have to say that is the tricky part, in a way that when they enter the Thailand and they realize they're actually more Burmese. So that's the encountering part of it. So that means as well with China itself, the Kachin actually in some ways did not really have much interaction with China in comparison with the Y or whatever. So they tend not to speak Chinese. And they have, like, they are Christians, and they have much more, they in some ways more oriented toward the West, I have to say. But in terms of the relations with the Chinese minorities, per se, you also have this similar kind of encountering process. You know, when they on the one hand talk about, like, common ethnic groups across the border, but then they do realize that we are Burmese Kachin, you are Chinese Kachin. They're actually very different. So the border, the nation, the sovereign, whatever, they do come into play in terms of how people demarcate that boundary of against each other. Yeah.
And I think so, yeah, after the meeting.
Okay. Yes.
Thank you so much for the talk, and it's very inspiring. Dr. O'Kinsey. It was very interesting argument because it kind of gives me a different way to think about tuning versus seafood in Europe, because the neighboring effect in Europe helped consolidating territorial control in Europe, but not in Myanmar. And I wonder, leading up to that, I wonder the condition of Myanmar as a British colony, higher proportion of ethnic minorities than other countries like China and Thailand, and multiple concurrent insurgencies and warlands that wouldn't happen in other two countries. I wonder if those conditions were destined the Myanmar to fail consolidating territory in the area, and how is that your theory of neighboring effect somehow differentiate that from conditions.
Right. So certainly you're right. I think British colonialism definitely left a very strong legacy, right? And this is not something that you experience that in China, nor in Thailand, right? So having said that, I think in terms of the obviously that the British were introduced different levels of governing in the peripheral regions in comparison with the rest of Burma, but in some ways those, how should I say, those kind of different levels of governance were also present in China and as well as in Thailand, right? In terms of, let's say, decentralized power into delegation into the local chieftains, right? So I do agree that the British legacy is quite profound, right? And in some ways, it's very difficult to talk about a counterfactual. What if there was no British colonial presence? What would happen, right? But somehow that was the case in Burma, right? But if you look at the on the other hand, right? So basically, Burma, India, and Bangladesh, and you do see a common British legacy. Right, in a way that those were all scheduled regions in Kachin State. Oh, sorry, in India, right? So in Assam, Manipur, and all the places, right? They were all historically actually part of Myanmar itself, right? But they were all delegated through different levels of local chieftains and etc. So you do see similarities, right, in terms of how the Indian state as well as the Bangladeshi state had a difficulty to consolidate those regions even after their own independence. Yeah. So I agree with you. Yes, the British legacy is quite profound, right? But you cannot really sort of eliminate it, right? Because it already happened, so it's nothing you can do about it.
Why do you think that Myanmar is not being able to mimic what European states were able to do through these neighboring effects, compared to state building policy?
I don't know. I think in European case, right, smaller states, if they meddled by the stronger ones, they probably already didn't exist. They probably already, even that Poland got conquered by Germany. Right, so that, I mean, in some ways, probably that, you know, I mean, lots of things people talk about, like the state death in the post World War II period, it didn't really exist anymore, right? Basically, there's no more state death. Somehow, the state will prolong themselves despite internally it's all fragmented and weak. Somehow, you can maintain a sovereign state. So imagine that was in Europe, probably a century or two ago. Then probably, I mean, I don't know. The other one might take over some of the territories to be itself, right? And Thailand did try, right? Thailand annexed two of the Shan states, Eastern Shan state during the Cold War, in 1940s, right? The eastern part of Shan state were annexed into Thailand as provinces. Yeah. Yes.
Just a follow-up comment on Min's point, which is you kind of resonated with it, but also the role of the missionaries. Because like the YMCA worked a lot in Yunnan during the Republican period and brought a lot of their ideas from the Southwest American reservations to Southern China about how to deal with the tribal people of the hills. So in addition to the point about the colonial legacy, also the missionary legacy amongst the Kachin and on the other side.
Right. Yeah. So the missionaries definitely were more, and now the missionaries and the colonialism always go together, right? And then particularly in the Myanmar's case, right, missionaries play a very important role in developing scripts and a set of national sense of self, right, through the missionary activities, right? So in Kachin and Qing and all of those places, basically, they were all product of missionary activities itself. And the missionaries were much less present in Thailand in comparison, right? And I think probably Thai state was more hostile to them. And then the Chinese state as well, I would say that was at one point, I mean, at least PRC was very hostile, right? And even before that, missionary tend not to be successful among the Han Chinese and tend to focus its project on the mountain people. So in that regard, you do have similarities in the way that it was the missionaries and the activity that contributed to lots of ethnic sense of group identity in many mountain people.
Looks like we've run out of questions as we've run out of time. So,
all right.
Please join me in thanking Enzo for the talk.
All right. So obviously, you know, if you are interested in buying a book, if you buy online, there's a flyer for 30%. So it's like $29.95, 30% off, it would be $21. If you want to buy it here, it's $20. So,
can we get an autograph?
Sure.
Yeah.